Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. We want you to stay with us. Very exciting program today. Very special guest, Greg Braden, will make a return visit to our program. He is the author of Walking Between the Worlds, The Isaiah Effect, Greg Braden audio collection series, The Divine Matrix, The Divine Name, The God Code, and so many others. We want you to join us because today we're going to be talking about turning point.
Walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I thank you so much for joining us on the program. I also thank our very special guest, Greg Braden, for joining us, and today we are going to be talking about his latest work, Turning Point, and we'll give you more information about that. Some of the other works that he has authored, Speaking the Lost Language of God, An Ancient Magical Prayer, Secret of the Lost Mode of Prayer, as I mentioned, The Divine Matrix, Spontaneous Healing of Belief, and The Science of Miracles. I mentioned Spontaneous Healing of Belief, The Mystery of 2012. We talked about the predictions, prophecies, and possibilities. Fractal Time, fascinating program, and we have that interview on our website. Entanglement, it's a tale of everyday magic. It is a novel, and there's a DVD that goes along with it. Deep Truth, and of course, the latest work, The Turning Point, Creating Resilience in a Time of Extremes. And it's my pleasure to welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, Greg Braden, one of my favorite guests. I've had the distinct pleasure of meeting him in person at an event that's coming up next weekend. It is the Conscious Life Expo, and it is going on down in Los Angeles. We'll talk more about that as well, but just the particulars, February 7th, 8th, and 9th, it is going to be at the LAX Hilton, and it is the Conscious Life Expo. Greg Braden will be a keynote speaker, and it sounds like your keynote, Greg, is going to be based an awful lot on your latest work, The Turning Point. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story.
Richard, it's great to hear your voice. You are my first interview for 2014, so I'm honored.
Well, I'm very excited about that as well. We've always wanted to have insights from you as we enter the years or leave the years, and we did that back in 2012 as well. So this is really interesting. Now, let's talk about turning points. I can look back. Hindsight, matter of fact, I was thinking about this as I was walking to lunch the other day. Hindsight is 20/20. What's the visual acuity of foresight? Because to me, foresight is blind. We can look back at points in our lives and say, you know, if I had just decided to go left instead of right, and you can pinpoint the exact moment, time, and space. But when it comes to making the right choices for not only your personal future, but as we've talked about the future of the race of man, it seems like it's totally impossible.
Well, this is, you've just covered a lot of ground in that one sentence, Richard.
I always do, I guess.
Yeah, well, so first of all, the new book, it is entitled The Turning Point, the subtitle, Creating Resilience in a Time of Extremes, and the multimedia presentation at Conscious Life Expo will be based largely upon that, the new book, as well as drawing from some new information that happened after the book was written, so I couldn't even put it in the book. So the answer is yes to that question. The key here, Richard, is that the experts are very good at predicting frightening times in our future called tipping points, and I know our listeners have all heard of tipping points of change when it comes to things like climate change, for example. When we reach the point where the climate is so far gone in one direction that it makes Earth uninhabitable, or the tipping points of the economy when so much debt is accumulated that everything just collapses. We're all familiar with those. What the experts overlook often is the fact that before you ever reach one of these frightening tipping points of no return, you must pass through at least one, and usually multiple, turning points. Turning points are nature's way of giving us the opportunity of avoiding the tipping points. A turning point is what happens. They can either be spontaneous or we can create them. But they're what happens when either a discovery changes the way we think about ourselves and what we believe about our relationship to the world, or an experience, it can be a paradigm-altering experience, changes our worldview. And when either of those things happen, that opens the door to move away from the path of the very frightening tipping points that we hear about so often. So the context of this new book, it is the fact of where we find ourselves in the world right now. We're living a time that the experts are calling a time of extremes. That doesn't mean that they have to be bad things or even good things, but definitely big things are happening in our world. Whether we're talking about climate change or the new economy that's emerging, or the fact that we are now living the peak oil scenarios that so many of us heard about, all of these extremes are creating a new normal in our world and in our lives. And the mainstream, Richard, has been in some cases resistant, some cases just flat out refusing to even acknowledge that this new normal is emerging. And so what's happening is, for many people, everybody knows something's up. Everybody knows the world is changing, something's going on.
Mm-hmm.
For many people, they are seeing the change as a temporary anomaly, and they're waiting for things to get back to normal. They're waiting for the return of whatever was normal for them in terms of jobs, economy, families, stability, careers, opportunities. In the world, it's a world that no longer exists. And the consequence of us not embracing the fact that we have lived in the new normal is that we are not allowing ourselves to mourn the passing of a world and a way of life so that we can let it go and make room for the new opportunities that allow us to thrive in the world that is emerging in our doorstep right now. When we embrace these facts, we create the tipping points or the turning points of change, that allow us to do just that, to literally thrive in some of the greatest economic and cultural crises that we've seen in our lifetime.
Another term that you used you've been using it for years, is choice point. And that, I know, is tied in with this as well.
Well, there is, it can be, and I'm going to make a distinction and actually do it in the beginning of the new book. There is a difference between a choice point and a turning point. A choice point is a specific point in time that can be mathematically calculated based upon previous cycles that open the door of opportunity and change in our lives. A turning point is not so precise, Richard. It's not linked to a cycle or a specific moment in time. Rather, it is linked to an experience, and the experience can be spontaneous, as we mentioned, or it can be something that we create. Let me just give some examples of big turning points in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, 1928, a Scottish scientist named Alexander Fleming went on vacation. And when he left his laboratory, he left a number of Petri dishes laying around, kind of disheveled, and he came back. And what he found is that there was a mold that had grown over his experiments. And in some instances, he would have looked at that mold and said, you know, I've ruined the experiment. He would have tossed them and started over again. But because he was a scientist, his trained eye, he looked at that mold and he said, why is the mold growing in some places and not others? And specifically, why are these certain kinds of bacteria and mold avoiding one another? And because he recognized that something was going on, something had changed, something was different, that led to the discovery of penicillin, and it forever changed our world. We may not have had that discovery if he had simply overlooked everything that was happening and said, you know, I screwed up when I left these Petri dishes here.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't happen that way. That was a spontaneous turning point in the life, in our world, in a big way. Landing of a man on the moon for the first time. forever change the way we think of ourselves in a relationship to the world. The election of Barack Obama is the first black president of the United States of America within the context of the history of our country. That was a turning point, not only for our nation, but for the world. So those are examples of some big turning points on a large scale, but they show up in our lives as well. And we're going to talk about how they show up, what they look like, what they mean, how to recognize them as we go through our conversation today. But I just kind of want to get some context for where we're going with this whole idea of turning points.
Absolutely. And as I say, I can look at two key moments in my life. I can go back there in my mind even as we speak. And due to my inability to control my impatience over having something now, I created for myself a path that I went down, a financial challenge. And I look back at those two moments and I said, I say to myself, I guess this is part of the danger, I think, that we need to balance. I think I've gone a little bit to an extreme and said, okay, I am not going to make that decision a third time. So now I really resist, making big purchases, that kind of thing. Not to say that I haven't, I certainly have, but it's one of those things where, even if my intuition says, no, this is perfect, go for it, do it. My mind, my intellect, and my memory say, no, don't do this because look what happened back there. So I'm taking the past and I'm projecting it onto the future, that whole mess. Instead of going with the here and now, intuition is saying, it's beautiful, perfect, go for it. It's going to work for you. And I think that's the dilemma that we as human beings have. And so we need to, as you've already outlined, we need to learn how to recognize these points along the line. And be able to discern and what we need to do next, because sometimes to do nothing might be the right answer, but yet at the same time, to take action may very well be the answer. And if we just sit there, then our world tends to sort of fall apart. And this is more on a personal level.
Sure. Well, this is where context is so important here, and it's the context of the new book.
Mm-hmm.
As well. The fact is that that the best minds of our time are now telling us that we are, in fact, living this time of extremes. And again, it's not necessarily people, when they hear that, sometimes they think of bad things. It's not necessarily bad things or even good things, but big things, whether we're talking about climate change in the world that is changing the weather in our own backyard.
Mm-hmm.
It's having a direct effect on the price of the food that we put on our family's dinner tables or the fuel that gets us back and forth to work every day. Or we're talking about the debt of our nation and the global economy and how that's impacted our ability to live in the way we have in the past, to create any semblance of savings or financial security for ourselves and our families, or put our kids to school or make the plans to do that. These are the kinds of extremes, and there are many different levels that we can look at. I'm just giving some examples here.
Mm-hmm.
That are leading to what is being called this new normal. But the key here is that there has been a reluctance, and in many cases, a flat-out resistance in the mainstream. Mainstream documentaries, mainstream news, mainstream media, mainstream classrooms, textbooks, to even acknowledge that this new normal is emerging. And the consequence of that is that many people are simply clinging to an idea of a world that they have known in the past as what their idea of normal is all about, and they're waiting for that world to return, and they put their lives on hold until that world comes back. They're not building new homes, they're not getting married, they're not having babies, they're afraid to take the risk of leaving one job and going to another because they don't know where things are going. So the consequence of not acknowledging the fact that we've entered this new normal is that we've never been given the opportunity through the mainstream and the broad general public to mourn the passing of a way of life and a way of thinking that served us only a few years ago, to mourn that and let it go so that we can make room for the opportunities that allow us to thrive in the new normal that's emerging. And I think, you know, Richard, those are big ideas, and I certainly recognize that. Can I share a story that maybe helps to illustrate that a little bit?
I would like for you to do that, but I'd also like for you to define for us, if you can maybe be a little bit more detailed, about what you mean by mourning the passing of the old norm.
That's where we're going to go with the story.
Go
so
for
my,
it, then.
I think you probably know, and I know many of our listeners know, my wife and I live in a rural area here in the high desert of northern New Mexico. And last fall, we were taking a drive up through the northern part of New Mexico into southern Colorado when we passed through some of the mining communities that are there. And I pulled into a convenience store. I stopped for gas and talked to the woman behind the cash register. And I asked her, I said, how are things in your community? How's the economy in this part of the world? You know, how are you all doing? And Richard, she didn't even look up from the cash register. She was counting money. She obviously had the conversation before. And she said, do you really want to know? And I said, well, of course I want to know. I wouldn't ask you. And then she did look up. And she said, when those mines are open and they're up and running, life here is good. She said, the money is good, security is good, people feel safe in their lives. And she said, when the mines close, life is hell. And I said, well, how many people do those mines employ? And she said, well, they're the largest employer in the county. 600 people work three shifts, 24/7 when they're open. And I said, well, 600 people, you know, that's a lot. How many people are in your community? And she said, well, there's 1,800 people in our community. So out of those 1,800, one-third of them, their livelihood depended upon what was happening in the mines, and the mines were closed. And I said, well, you know, that's got to be tough. You know, what's everybody doing? And she said, they're doing whatever they can, waiting for things to get back to normal. And this is why I'm sharing this story. She said they're baling hay for their neighbors, they're fixing cars, they're working on roofs, whatever they can, biding their time, waiting for things to get back to normal. And I said, how long have the mines been closed? She said, 9 years. 9 years,
wow.
Those people in that community essentially put everything, put their lives on hold. They're not building new homes. They're not getting married. They're not having babies and creating new families. And the community, it's reflected in the community. It looks very tired, not a lot of new anything going on there. And as I left that convenience store, I couldn't help but think, Richard, that in those few moments with that woman, I've experienced, in a sense, a microcosm of what many people are experiencing all over the world. And it is simply this fact. The world changed, and no one told us. There was no BBC special or CNN special, you know, saying, you know, flash, the world changed. So many people rely upon mainstream media to inform them of the world and what's happening in the world and their place in it. So because we've never had this story shared in the way that I'm describing right now, we've never been given the opportunity to do what we do when anything that we love and care about disappears from our lives. We've never had the opportunity to mourn, to acknowledge the existence of a way of thinking and living that it worked for us for most of our lives, and to acknowledge that it no longer exists, to acknowledge that we miss that way of life. We miss the little mom-and-pop shops, you know, that they used to fix everything from the holes in our shoes to the holes in the tires. The lawnmowers that we used to use to mow the lawns that we used to have in the homes that we used to own. I miss those things.
Yeah.
And our world is changing in that way. And this is a subtle and powerful thing for us as all to be aware of is when we continue to cling to the idea of the world, waiting for that world to come back, then there's no room for the new world and the new opportunities to emerge and allow us literally to thrive in the new normal, because those opportunities are filled with the expectations and the hopes of things coming back to normal. And as I've traveled the world, last 5 years I've been on every continent of the earth except Antarctica. And even this last year, 2013, I was all over the world, Australia, South America, all through Europe, and parts of Asia. And the story, people describe it differently, Richard, but almost universally. There's a sense that something happened, that the world was chugging along. You know, we had our ups and downs. It was chugging along, worked pretty well. Something happened, and for some people, they say it was 9/11, that the world's never been the same. Or some people say it was the economic crash of 2008 for them. But the sense is that we've entered into something that has yet to complete. And it's common in Western Europe. I hear the term, the other shoe has yet to fall. So we're in something. It hasn't finished yet. We don't know exactly what it means or where it's going. And that our life and our world feels a little unsettled. And that's the whole point of the book, the turning point. And it simply begins with a story. When we go on a journey, any journey, we check out where we're going to go, and we pack what we think we need to maintain our routines for that journey. And if we find ourselves going somewhere we've never been, then we pack accordingly and we prepare. And that's the whole point of the book, because we're all on a big journey, and we don't know exactly where it's leaving. And the way that we pack and prepare for this journey is to create resilience in our bodies to the change and the stress that's happening, resilience in our families and our communities collectively, and on a larger scale, even on a national or global level, resilience that allows us to thrive by adapting to the new normal rather than thinking of the new normal as an anomaly and waiting for the old world to come back. So
yeah,
that's a lot in one sentence, but that hopefully that story helps to illustrate a little bit. That community is still there, and they're still waiting.
They're still waiting.
For the world, the old world. And part of the problem, the mineral that's being mined in that community, it's a mineral called molybdenum, or shortened to moly, and it's used to harden steel. And one of the reasons that it may not come back to that community is because China is now producing that mineral less expensively, more of it, and cheaper than they could at the mines here in America, and that's why they shut down those mines.
Wow.
I don't know if that's going to change anytime in the near future.
Well, I think that, first of all, the musical group REM had it right a few years back with their song, "It Is the End of the World as We Know It." And every day, the world ends, and a new one is born the next day. And I think that's one of the things, I think, and it's great advice. So I think what we're going to do here on Tell Me Your Story on this program right now, Greg, we are going to announce that the old world is gone. It's dead. It's over. It's time for you to take time to mourn and grieve the loss so that you can move forward into whatever the new norm is going to look like. And we don't know. And honestly, Greg, it's funny when you describe all of this. I think especially when I think about economics and the pundits and Wall Street, they've never known what the future is going to hold. They think they know. They predict. They hope. They guess. They wonder. But they don't know any more than you and I. We could roll the dice and be right or wrong just like them. And yet they merrily roll along doing their thing. And now all of a sudden, with all of these extremes happening, it's like, oh, we don't know what's going to happen. Well, you never did in the first place when things were going well. And the same thing with the weather and anything else for that matter, because you don't know if you're going to cross a street and get hit by a bus or a plane's going to drop out of the sky, et cetera, et cetera. So keeping those things in mind, it's okay now. Let's take the time to do that, just as if we had lost a dear loved one. And a matter of fact, that's interesting the way that you put this, because in a real sense, I think, for many people, the norm, as it always was a dear friend, a loved one, because it was comfortable, it was warm and inviting.
Absolutely.
And familiar. And now it's gone.
We thought we mastered that world pretty well. And I don't know if you know this, I have a 6-week radio program that I'm hosting. I just began on with our publisher on Hay House Radio.
Wonderful.
We had this conversation with our listeners, and one of the things I invited people to do, and I'm just going to tie back into this morning, don't do this if you're driving or operating heavy machinery, okay?
Please.
But to take just take the time, take a piece of paper, and you're not going to show this to anyone else or, you know, mail in or anything, but write down on that piece of paper the things that are different. I'm inviting our listeners to do this. Write down the things that are different in your life now than they were, say, even 5 years ago.
Mm.
And the things that have disappeared from your life that you recognize that they're gone and you miss them. And it's okay to miss them. Write those down and acknowledge what those are, and then the feelings that you have around those. And there is a very real healing that begins first by simply acknowledging this. And the next step in this mourning process, now that we're talking about it, and I actually have a step-by-step instruction in the new book, The Turning Point, that leads us through this, is to be aware of the feelings that you have around the things that are gone, whether it's sadness or emptiness or a sense of loss. I don't want to put words on your paper, but those give you some idea. Those are the kinds of things we're talking about.
Sure.
And there is a process where we then go into our heart center. We physically touch our heart center with our fingertips. And by doing that, your awareness will automatically go to the place where you feel that sensation on your body. It doesn't have to be a big, you know, ceremonial thing. Just simply sit at your desk or wherever you are and touch your heart center. And as your awareness moves into your heart, this is where the work begins. Whatever those feelings are, we can consciously replace those feelings with what we would call positive feelings that serve us and that are life-affirming. So the sadness, for example, of what no longer exists, we can breathe into that sadness the joy of how well those things served us, how much we did enjoy them, and how lucky we were to have them in our lives, and how grateful we are for the new opportunities now that are showing up. That's just an example of how you can replace one set of feelings and emotions intentionally with another. And this is part of the mourning process.
Mm-hmm.
But the net effect of all of this is that by allowing ourselves to mourn the passing, and, you know, it just keeps coming back to me. We live here in a relatively small community in northern New Mexico. I remember when Borders bookstores closed up and went out of business. And there was a Borders that I used to see. I'm sorry, is it Borders or Barnes? No, it's Borders. there was a Borders I used to see on a corner that I used to drive by all the time. I used to go in and look at a lot of people's books, including my own there. And I miss seeing that. I miss, you know, some of the little grocery stores that have disappeared. I miss the dairy farms bringing eggs and milk to our door once a week. It's something that used to happen. It doesn't happen anymore. I miss those things.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's bad. We're just acknowledging that they're no longer here, and they used to be a part of our lives. And as we do that, we make room for the new things.
Exactly.
That are happening. And I don't. Do we take a break on your program?
Matter of fact, we do, and we're going to be taking one here shortly.
That's what I thought. When we come back from the break, I'd like to share a true life account of how this plays out in our lives in a really practical way.
Yeah. Well, this is fabulous stuff, and again, I encourage our listeners to pick up a copy of the book because I think that it can give you some good insights. The Turning Point, Creating Resilience in a Time of Extremes. Also, a reminder that Greg is going to be I have the name right here. Why can't I find it here? There
it's
it is.
Conscious Life Expo.
Conscious Life Expo.
Yeah.
Going down at the LAX Hilton, February 7, 8, and 9. That's next weekend. Unfortunately, I won't be able to make it because I'm going to be here live doing a show with my Vedic astrologer. We'll be taking people's calls live and giving them readings. So a little preview for next Saturday. But we'll continue with Greg Braden. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we will be right back.
Now
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're talking with Greg Braden and his latest work, which I'm real excited about, and I've only just begun to scratch the surface of it. It's called The Turning Point, Creating Resilience in a Time of Extremes. And we were talking before the break, Greg, about mourning the things that were and being grateful for the new things that are coming. And what it reminded me of was a process my wife and I are going through up on the hill above Santa Barbara where we live. We've gone through all of the containers under the house that have been stored there since we moved there in May of 2006. Some of them hadn't even been opened since we moved in May of 2006. And we finally went through every single box, and we decided this is going to go in the trash, this is going to go into recycling, this is going to go to someone, and we're going to see if we can get some money for this. And, you know, it was this whole process didn't take that long. I'm going through that process in my studio. I went through, I kid you not, Greg, a foot of stacked papers of things that I had printed out, receipts, information from my, I call them my vendors, like my insurance company, et cetera, et cetera. And I went through and I filled up one of these plastic containers. Now I have to go get myself a shredder so that I can shred this up and feel safe that when this goes into the recycle, nobody's going to play games with my numbers and things of this nature. But it's that process of moving things through, in other words, keeping the flow going. And what you talked about just before we went to break was about making room for the new things, the new changes, the new world, as it were. And I suppose I could put it this way. We sort of become our own Christopher Columbus, if you will, or Marco Polo, or whoever you want, whatever great adventurer, discoverer down through history. When we start entering each new day, not knowing what's coming up on the shore, what we're going to find when we set foot on land, and I say this all metaphorically, and where we're going to be come the next day and the next day. And it's okay in these uncertain times or extreme times, if you will, to make plans. My wife and I, we're making plans. You know, we haven't given that up. A lot of folks, though, like you used a great example of people like in that one community, they've just basically said, everything on hold until things get back to normal. And right. They're going to be on hold until the day they die, unless they wake up. So you were going to take us in a direction that I think is quite appropriate. But I just want to remind our listeners that you're going to be at the Conscious Life Expo the 7th, 8th, and 9th next weekend. Keynote speaker, I believe it's 4 to 5:30 p.m. at the LAX Hilton. And they can go to that website, which is consciouslifeexpo.com. So I'm going to turn it over to you for the next few moments. And please take us on a wonderful journey regarding this process of opening up to the flow.
Well, I will. And before we do that, I just want to say, for those of you coming to the Conscious Life Expo, it is a multimedia presentation that I'm putting together, packed with visuals, a lot of things that we're not talking about here on this program today. But what is it that makes our time so unique? And how those extremes show up in our world and in our lives? Because a lot of people, you know, it's so interesting, Richard, whether you're talking to your banker or financial advisor, maybe you mentioned before, or talking to real estate agents, or they're among the people who are waiting for things to get back to normal. And what they're saying is, stay the course, do what we've always done in the past, make these choices, these decisions, these purchases in your life, and everything is going to be okay. And the reality is that the world where those things made sense is the world that's gone. And I think it's so interesting to see how this, even our politicians, running for elected office, to see the promises, them promising for things to get back to a norm that we were comfortable with in the past. So it plays out in a lot of different ways, and I'm going to be able to share that with our audience as well as many things that we're doing right now. So it'll be a very fast-paced, very visual program. So we're covering some big ideas, and I know for some people it's right along the lines of what you've always thought and believed, and for others this is a new way of thinking about things. So I wanted just to share something very concrete and practical, and if we have time maybe do a couple of stories like this. But As I mentioned, my wife and I live in rural northern New Mexico. Climate change is wreaking havoc in the Southwest in general, and certainly in our part of the world. We're in the seventh year of the worst drought anyone remembers, even the elders in the native Pueblos. They're 100-plus years old. They say it's never been like this. Families that have raised cattle for four generations are selling their herds because the land won't support the cattle or the crops any longer. So there's a friend of ours. He's a neighbor and a friend, and his name is Ken. I write about Ken in the book in more detail than what I'm going to share here. But the key here is that Ken, he was a builder of ecologically sound homes in the desert Southwest for 30 years, 30-plus years, beautiful homes. And he and a crew of about 35 people began the largest project that they had ever undertaken to build a whole community of these homes, and it was the year 2008. So I think our listeners know that was not only the year of an economic downturn, but it was the year of a downturn in housing as well. The project fell through. He lost everything. He had no way to provide for himself or the people dependent on him, his crew, 35-plus people for work. And I know a lot of our listeners, while they may not be builders, they can relate to this because industries are disappearing, jobs are disappearing, and our security, economic security, is disappearing. So Ken, I had these conversations with him. And for some of our listeners, I know you were with us in our previous programs. My book of 2011 was called Deep Truth. And the bottom line of that book was a series of discoveries that overturn the scientific story of the way we think of ourselves and our relationship to the world. So for 150 years, we've been led to embrace a story of separation and competition, that nature is based upon this model of survival of the strongest. In the last years of the 20th century, that story changed. And now we know that nature is actually based on a model of cooperation, and that we live in a world of connectivity rather than separation. So those scientific facts play into the story with Ken. In the old world, the world of the past that we're now letting go, the science of separation led each of us to ask a question. Whenever we made a decision about a relationship or romance or a job or healthcare or whatever it is, there was a question, and the question based in separation was this: what can I get from the world that exists? What can I get? What's in this for me if I make this choice or this decision or take this job or enter this relationship? The new science that now tells us we live in a world of cooperation where everything's connected, it invites us to change the question. And the new question becomes, what can I share? What can I contribute? What can I offer? What can I give to the world that's emerging? And that is a fundamentally different question. So, 3 o'clock in the morning, my friend Ken bolted up in the middle of the night, and he asked himself this question. He said, what does the world need right now? He didn't say, how can I recreate my job as a builder, or where can I go to do what I've always done? He said, what does the world need? And the next morning, his answer to that was, the world needs to eat and to be able to care for themselves. He began designing, prototyping, and building an innovative series of raised bed, modular, self-heating, self-watering greenhouses. They're covered. They will grow produce 12 months out of the year, no matter what the outside conditions are. And Ken now has begun to build these so successfully in the high deserts here, he's now shipping them all over the world. And he's having so much fun doing this that not only is he able to support himself and his family and his crew, he's had to hire more people. And I would be surprised if he ever went back to building homes again, because he feels so good about helping people to care for themselves and doing so in the way that he's doing. And I'm sharing this story as an example, because Ken's world changed, and he could have succumbed to the belief that this is a temporary anomaly and just done something to get by, waiting for the world to return to normal. But he recognized that this is a new world. It's a new reality, and the extremes what we call the extremes, they're the new normal. So he said, what is it that I have that can help the people I care about, my family, my neighbors, my friends, and the world at large? And this is important. He didn't say, what am I qualified to do? What's my degree in? Do I have a certificate? Do I have the experience? He said, what is it that I can contribute? And my sense is that we all have this within us. We all are trained or conditioned to do certain things to create a living. And for some of us, it also happens to be the things that bring us joy and passion in our lives. And I also know for a lot of people, they do one job to give them the freedom to do the things that bring them joy and passion in another area in their lives. And my sense is that joy and that passion is probably what the world needs from you right now. So if you are at a point, I'm speaking directly to our listeners, if you're at a point at a crossroads where your world is in turmoil, or your friends, or your family, or your neighbors, and the world of the past that has disappeared no longer supports the way that you have made a living and provided for yourself and your family in the past. And this covers, you know, everything from spiritual principles to metaphysical principles to, you know, real life, everyday, nuts and bolts kinds of things. It all comes together here in the mix. I would invite you to ask yourself, what is it that your friends and your family, what do they need right now in your community? And not your degree or your certificate or your experience, but what is it in your passion that can contribute to create a better community, a better neighborhood? And the way that you answer that question, it opens the door to a vast array of possibilities. It changes everything. And I'm seeing people thrive, literally thrive, in the worst economic downturn of 80 years in the West, to a degree greater than they ever did in the past. And they're healthier, they're happier, they have closer families, better community ties, and all they did was change the question. So I wanted to share that story, and there are others we could share. I'm not sure how much time we have here, but these are the kinds of stories that I'm hearing from people all over the world that are successfully navigating this new normal and adapting. This is a part of resilience, adapting to the new extremes rather than looking at them as anomalies in our lives. Does that make sense, Richard, what we're saying?
It makes very, very good sense, perfect sense to me. It also changes my perspective a little bit, because I took the position back as people were losing their jobs across the country. One of the thoughts that ran across my mind, and I was kind of criticized for the thought, because it's easy for me to say this, but of the people who lost their jobs, I speculated, I guessed that maybe 95, maybe 99% of them hated the job that they were laid off from anyway. And so now here's the universe giving them the opportunity to do just exactly what your friend Ken did. And that is maybe not ask that specific question, but pursue their life's purpose, their passion. I still remember a public service announcement from years ago where it would go. It started out with a little boy playing with his dump truck and tractors and things like that in the dirt in his backyard. And then they switch to an adult who is a contractor. He's building a road with the same kinds of things. And then you see switching back to a little girl playing with, and it may be stereotyped, but nonetheless, the message was the same. Playing with her dolls and maybe taking care of them. She looked like she was wrapping the little doll's hand in a bandage or something. Switched to a medic in the military field. Okay. Mm-hmm. But the point being that what they loved doing and playing as a child, how they loved playing as a child is what they ended up doing as adults.
Well, I think that it's probably true for a lot of us. And you know, Ken shares the story. It worked for him in that way. There are other stories. I have another neighbor, and we live in a remote valley. We're an hour from the nearest town, 4 hours from the nearest airport. But another neighbor who is a physicist at Los Alamos National Labs. When the labs, the crisis hit, the labs lost a lot of their funding. And he had a conference with his family. Now, he would have to get up and drive almost 2 hours to work him back every single day. He'd been with him with the labs for years, you know, secret projects and all kinds of things. He was losing touch with his family. He didn't know his wife anymore. Their lives had become separate. His kids were growing up. He didn't, you know, wasn't in touch with his kids' lives. They sat down at the family kitchen table, and he said, "What do you want me to do?" He said, "Do you want me to go and recreate the life that we've had somewhere else?" He could do it. He was a degreed physicist. He could have done that. He said, "Or you want to try something else?" And the family made a decision to let all of that go and to take a leap. And what they did was they bought a herd of llamas from a rancher in Peru, South America, in Peru, where the environment is very similar to the high desert in northern New Mexico. They brought the llamas up together as a family. They are raising the llamas. They get up in the morning. They care for them together as a family. So they're creating their own well-being together. They shear them for their wool a couple of times a year. And in the summer months, when the weather is really beautiful and warm, they have these small saddle bags they put on the llamas, and tourists will come, and each tourist has a llama that they will, they don't ride them, but they will walk with them. They lead them on a trek up into the Sangre de Cristo Mountains in northern New Mexico on a day hike or maybe an overnight hike and back, so that the tourists get to know the land, they get to know the animals, the family gets to work together to give them that experience. The man is healthier than he's been for a very long time, and the family is happier. He and his wife know each other again now in ways they haven't for a long time, and he feels like he's part of his kids' lives. And all he did was ask that question, and he asked it as a family.
Yeah.
What is it? What do we want our lives to look like? And they, you know, they had to learn.
Yeah.
They didn't have a degree in llama raising, you know, or anything like that. It's just a choice they made. This, we want our lives to be healthier and happier and closer together.
Yeah.
And that's just another way that this question comes about.
You know, that's fascinating, because when you tell these stories, these two in particular, a flippant comment about the second one was, "Oh, that's just crazy talk, Greg. That's impossible. They can't be doing that." But when I start thinking about the plans that my wife and I have, which are so, I mean, most everybody knows that one of the places, one of our dreams is to live, my home base. I want my home base to be Ireland one day, one day soon. But in the meantime, we have some other plans. And right now we're living in probably 1,000-square-foot two-room cottage up on the hill above Santa Barbara. And it's cozy and it's comfortable, and we've made it our own, and we don't own it. And there's a certain level of freedom in that as well. And I don't know what the next step is going to be. You know, we've talked about, I don't know if you have watched many movies in the past or not, but there's a wonderful one with Albert Brooks where he and his wife decide that they're going to quit their jobs and travel across country. Lost in America is the name of the movie.
I didn't see the movie.
Oh, they get this Winnebago, and they take their giant nest egg, and they begin to travel across the country. And I won't go any further than that, other than to say that they made the decision to do something different. And I think that that's really where we're coming from on this program today, that it's time to start thinking. There's part of me that still likes the phrase, think outside the box. I want to throw the box away. I want to put it in the recycle bin and not even consider the box and just start thinking creatively and just let it flow, because you have no idea where it's going to take you.
Or you can say the whole world is the box, so there's nothing outside the box.
Well, that is a good point.
Yeah. I think the thing is, it's when people find that the choices they've made and the life that they've created is no longer supported in the world,
yeah,
for whatever reason. And, you know, we all go through speed bumps in life, and
sure,
we have to discern when they're temporary and when they're not. But, for example, the people in the community in the mining communities, you know, after 5 or 6 years, I think that's a pretty good signal from the universe that what you used to do probably isn't going to work anymore.
Yeah.
And it's our fear of the unknown for many people, and our... we have a propensity to cling to the familiar.
Yeah.
For many people, I know change is very, very hard for a lot of people. My grandfather, died at the age of 96. And right before he died, he and I had this conversation. Richard, it was very interesting because I asked him. I said, you know, you're 96. You've seen the world go through a lot of changes. You know, tell me about it. And he said, you know, there was a time that the world made sense to me. This is my grandfather talking to me. And he said, I felt like I understood the world. Everything made sense. And he said, then something happened, and all of that changed. And he said, it was like right after World War II. Technology took off so quickly in ways that he couldn't connect with. It didn't make sense to him. He couldn't understand how you could put a piece of paper into a phone machine, you know, in one building and have it come out somewhere else, you know, saying the same thing, a fax.
Yeah.
Or computers or telephones or jet planes, you know, those things. He never caught up with that world that changed. He was waiting for things to get back to the world he knew, and he felt lost. He died feeling like an outsider, like he'd been left behind in his own world. And I'm not saying that's true of everyone, but I think that sense for so many people, the world has just changed so very quickly, and we're, you know, we don't live in separate nations the way we did 10 years ago, and separate economies, and separate communications, and separate defense, and technological conditions. All that's changed, and our ideas about money are changing, and security, and jobs, and how we contribute. All that's changing now.
Yeah.
And if we cannot find a way to embrace that change, then our fear keeps us stuck in the place where we say, well, you know, we're waiting for things to get back to normal. I remember my my father worked for IBM for 30 years before he died. He died at a young age. And I remember asking my father my first year in college about whether or not I should take a computer programming class. And my dad, I always remember this, his words, he said, don't waste your time. Computers are a fad. They're not going to last. or you remember when rock music came out in the 50s and a lot of the world, the industry said, this is it's a passing fad.
Yeah.
Don't give it a second thought. And it changed everything.
Yeah.
So there's something many of our listeners have probably heard of called normalcy bias. Normalcy bias is our propensity to overlook big change and try to normalize it into our everyday lives. So when big things happen, we tend to discount it.
Yeah.
The classic example, and I'm not saying this is happening now, but if you look this up in a medical textbook, a classic example would be in World War II in the ghettos when the Jewish people saw their friends and neighbors being loaded onto boxcars, and they'd heard the rumors of what was going to happen, but they also heard that those people were being shipped off to new housing communities and a better life. And they so wanted to believe the latter that they overlooked what the realities were that were staring them in the face, and many of them ended up dying needlessly when they had many opportunities to leave. And that is an example of normalcy bias. Sometimes the change is so big and so hard and so unbelievable we can't grasp it. And, to a lesser extent, I think many people now are seeing the economy is changing. Things don't work the way they used to.
Yeah.
Climate is changing. It's not going to go back in our lifetime. I can tell you as a geologist, climate change is a fact. It's here to stay. And we may do things to change our lifestyle.
Yeah.
And that's always a good thing to do, but the realities of climate change are with us. So my sense and the message in this book is that we're better off adapting to the extremes of the new normal so that we incorporate them into our worldview rather than acting surprised when, you know, when a big storm happens or a big flood happens or a big economic collapse happens, we act surprised as if we're caught off guard. That's the normalcy bias.
Yeah, yeah. A reminder that we're talking with Greg Braden, his latest work, The Turning Point, Creating Resilience in Times of Extreme. He is also going to be at the Conscious Life Expo next weekend, the 7th, 8th, and 9th of February. And there'll be a post conference on the 10th. This is all going on at the LAX Hilton, and that is the Conscious Life Expo. Greg will be the keynote speaker on Saturday, the 8th at 4 p.m., and you can go to consciouslifeexpo.com to get all the information regarding this wonderful event. I've attended one of these a couple of years ago, had a chance to meet you in person, which was very nice, very quick, but it was okay. You're a busy guy, and I didn't want to get in your way, and so we just said hi and bye and let
you... I didn't recognize you at first because I know your voice, but yeah. I don't know your face.
Exactly.
So Richard, I was just going to ask if you've been to many of these expos before. They are a real mix.
Yes.
Of all kinds of information. It's like a one-stop shop for every kind of information that you could imagine with regard to the new thought, new science, new world that, mm-hmm. that's emerging.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to go and see so many different perspectives and some people I've heard all my life speaking there, some I've never heard of before, and I meet them for the first time. But for me, it is also an opportunity to really reach a broad cross-section of our world, of a broad general audience. It's not just a scientific crowd or a new thought crowd or a medical or a technological engineering crowd. It's a cross-section of all of those, and it's quite a weekend. It really is.
It is, and I would have to say that, and I have to be honest about this, you do need to go to the Conscious Life Expo with no expectations or preconceived notions in your head. You really have to go with an open mind, because you are going to hear, not just from the lecturers, but if you go through the exhibit booths and so forth, there are people there from almost every corner of the spectrum when it comes to new thought and new paradigms and all of this. Some of it you're going to agree with. Some of it you're going to disagree with. Some of it you're going to shake your head. You got to be kidding. Some of it, it's going to resonate with you. And as I've always said about this program, check out the website of our guests, because you may find something there that will resonate with you. Maybe not the whole thing, but little bits and pieces. And that's all we ask, is it's a smorgasbord. Take what you need, leave the rest, and enjoy yourself. That's really the bottom line, is enjoy yourself.
We go to the Conscious Life Expo with consciousness, right?
That's it. You do. I mean, I went there, what was it? I think it was last year maybe, or the year before. No, it was the year before, 2012. And I came across some interesting folks, and even though I was a little skeptical about where they were coming from, I still stood and I listened to what they had to say, no matter how far out it might have been, because I don't know if the universe is trying to communicate something through them to me. I kind of go back to James Redfield's Celestine Prophecy about how each of us has a message for one another, and that if we cut ourselves off from one another, we don't get the messages, and we don't get to share the messages with other people. And so it's to me, it's really important that if you're going to attend something like this, and it's great fun, it really is, and they've got some pretty good food down there too. But the lectures are great. You're going to meet folks like Greg Braden. I know George Norrie's going to be there, and just a whole host of other folks. So we want you to check that out. Greg, before we run out of time, and in the last couple of minutes, the one thing that's been kind of pressing on my brain here throughout the entire interview, and I was waiting till the end to ask this of you, I don't think I've ever asked you this question in all the years that we've been talking. Why is any of this stuff that we've talked about over the last 10 or 15 years and all of the books that you've written, why do you care about any of this stuff?
Are you asking me why I care personally?
Yeah.
Well, that's a very easy question for me to answer. I love this world. I love the people of this world. And I feel like we are at a rare and precious juxtaposition in beliefs and choices of the way we live and how we treat one another as we go through some of the greatest shifts of power and wealth and thinking in 5,000 years of recorded human history. We have an opportunity, a rare, precious opportunity, to press that reset button, to press the reset button, and to build a paradigm of aliveness that honors us, our relationship to ourselves, and the principles of the earth, in a way that we simply didn't recognize in these last 5,000 years in the modern world. So I think it's worth exploring these possibilities, finding out what works and what doesn't. And the things that work, let's do a lot of them. The things that don't work, let's stop doing them altogether.
If folks want to get in touch with you directly, they can certainly go to your website, gregbraden.com. Also check out consciouslifeexpo.com for the expo next weekend. And Greg, we're just about out of time. Thanks so much for the hour that you've given us. This has been fabulous. You are a precious gift to all of us, and to me in particular. I just love chatting with you and look forward to doing it again soon.
I look forward to it, Richard. Our time went by very quickly, and next time, let's make that meeting at the Conscious Life Expo last a little bit longer, okay?
You got it. I will make a conscious effort.
Thank you, my brother, and thanks to all of our listeners. Thank you for all you're doing to make this world a better place. Take good care.
You bet. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And until next week, love Talal.